Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 5th of September. Our main stories: the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson loses again over Brexit and calls an early election, but the opposition refuses. We'll have the latest from Westminster. The number of people killed by Hurricane Dorian in the Bahamas has risen to 20. And YouTube is fined $170 million for violating children's privacy laws. Also in this podcast:
I feel a lot threatened because as a parent and as a business owner, I'm living in constant fear because you don't know what will happen tomorrow.
Reports of xenophobic attacks on foreign workers in South Africa, which have sparked a bitter row with Nigeria. When he became Prime Minister at the end of July, Boris Johnson said with certainty outside his new home, 10 Downing Street, that Britain would leave the European Union on October the 31st, no ifs or buts. But after a series of defeats in Parliament, it's looking as if he may not be able to deliver on his promise. And as a result, he's resorted to calling an early general election, something he categorically ruled out just 6 weeks ago. A tumultuous day in Parliament started with Prime Minister's questions, where Mr. Johnson was expected to use his rhetorical skills to outshine his main opponent, the opposition Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. But the two traded angry words, and the Prime Minister was put on the spot by a Sikh MP, Tanmanjit Singh Desi, over a newspaper article in which Mr. Johnson had claimed that Muslim women in burqas look like letterboxes. There were boos and cheers as the Prime Minister arrived.
This government will take this country out of the European Union on October the 31st. There is only one thing that stands in our way. It is the surrender bill currently being proposed by the leader of the opposition.
These negotiations that he talks about are a sham. All he's doing is running down the clock.
I know he's worried about free trade deals with America, but there's only one chlorinated chicken that I can see in this house, and he's on that bench. Will he confirm again? Will he confirm? Will he confirm that he will let the people decide? Let the people decide on what he is doing to this country's negotiating position by having a general election on October the 15th.
Yesterday, he lost one vote, his first vote in Parliament. He now wants to dissolve Parliament. He's desperate, absolutely desperate, to avoid scrutiny.
When will the Prime Minister finally apologise for his derogatory and racist remarks? Racist remarks, Mr. Speaker, which have led to a spike in hate crime.
We truly reflect modern Britain, and Mr. Speaker, what we have yet to hear from anywhere in the Labour Party is any hint of apology for the virus of anti-Semitism that is now rampant in their ranks. And I would like to hear that from the honourable member opposite.
Well, Boris Johnson has spent only 3 working days in the House of Commons as Prime Minister, but he's lost 4 votes in 24 hours. Opposition members worked with rebels in his Conservative Party to take control of the agenda from the government and pass a bill which stops him taking Britain out of the EU without a deal. This is now being debated in the upper chamber, the House of Lords, so it can become law. The Prime Minister's next move was to call a snap general election for October the 15th, but it failed to get the required support of 2/3 of MPs. Mr. Johnson said that Mr. Corbyn was a coward.
I think he has become the first, to my knowledge, the first leader of the opposition in the democratic history of our country to refuse the invitation to an election, Mr. Speaker. I can only speculate as to the reasons behind his hesitation, Mr. Speaker. The obvious conclusion is, I'm afraid, that he does not think he will win.
Labour had been calling for an election, but Mr. Corbyn and other opposition members want the no-deal law in place first.
The offer of the election today is a bit like the offer of an apple to Snow White and the Wicked Queen, because what he's offering is not an apple or even an election, but the poison of a no deal. So, Mr. Speaker, I repeat what I said last night. Let this bill pass and gain royal assent, then we will back an election so we do not crash out with a no-deal exit from the European Union.
So, what happens now? Here's our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
It still needs to get approved by the second chamber, the unelected House of Lords, and after that it needs to be approved by the Queen. Now, it's possible we may have all of that done, given royal assent, in the next 48, 72 hours.
But there is some talk that some in the Lords will try to stop its progress by, what, talking it out like they do in the States, filibustering.
That is possible, although, of course, it would be immensely controversial for an unelected chamber to throw out something that had been passed by an elected chamber. Now, these are very controversial times, so you wouldn't entirely rule it out, but I do think in the end it'll get passed.
Now, when MPs were voting on that bill, there was even one amendment calling for a version of Theresa May's deal to come back. What's that all about?
I think one shouldn't get too bogged down in all of that because it doesn't really fundamentally change the idea of the bill, which is basically to say that, look, Britain can't leave the European Union without a deal on October the 31st. There would need to be a three-month extension.
Boris Johnson says he needs to have that option in his hand while he's negotiating with the EU. And as a result of that, though, he wants an election. But how come he can't have one?
The reason he can't have one is because we have something called the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which was passed in 2010, which changed the law so as it wasn't just at the discretion of a prime minister to call to decide exactly when an election should come about, and that you need two-thirds majority of the rest of MPs. And here's the thing. The opposition parties, they do want a general election, but they're not sure that they want to do it on Boris Johnson's terms. And in particular, I think what an awful lot of them would prefer to do is to have an extension to Brexit, so get that agreed, a three-month extension, and then potentially have an election then. Whereas what Mr. Johnson, of course, wants to do is to have an election on October the 15th, so he can still say, and I promise he'll make the pledge at that election, dither and dither and dither under all the opposition parties, Brexit delivered one way or another under me if you vote for me on October the 31st.
So, I mean, who will decide what happens? Because if the bill gets through the Lords, he's not allowed to have a no deal, but there is no election.
No, that is absolutely right. Well, to some extent, Mr. Johnson is in a bit of a fix, and some might say he might have overplayed his hand. I mean, on the other hand, you see, this can't go on forever. I mean, the opposition parties understand that now that the government has lost its majority, Mr. Johnson can continuously taunt them. Well, you always say you want an election. I don't have a majority. You won't allow me to pass any laws. Goodness gracious, are you hiding from the will of the British people? So, look, there will be a general election. It's just not entirely clear whether it'll be just before the Brexit date of October 31st or after that's been extended.
Rob Watson in Westminster. Well, the Prime Minister had argued he was making progress in getting a new deal with the EU, but that's been rejected by politicians in Europe. The Irish Foreign Minister says the British still haven't proposed any solutions to the major sticking points. And Michel Barnier, the chief European Brexit negotiator, is reported to have told European diplomats that negotiations are in a state of paralysis. Our Europe editor is Katja Adler.
The Prime Minister's main EU envoy was actually in Brussels today for talks with the European Commission. Now, they, of course, negotiate a Brexit deal on behalf of the whole of the EU. And I've been told now by several sources who said that Mr. Frost came up with no new ideas, no UK proposal on how to redefine the Brexit deal, and not even a hint of one, some person said to me. And that is leading EU leaders to think that Boris Johnson doesn't actually have a solution for the Brexit deal up his sleeve, despite the rhetoric. If he had that solution, they ask, why hasn't he presented it to us by now? But there is a stark contrast, I think, by the kind of emotional debate we're seeing inside Parliament at the moment and the mood in Brussels. The EU is very much waiting on the sidelines here. Waiting and drinking tea is how one diplomat put it to me. So there's talk of a general election, talk of another Brexit extension, which, by the way, if the UK were to ask, EU leaders would almost certainly grant. but they say they'll believe it when it actually happens.
Our Europe editor, Katja Adler. Other news now, and the leader of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, has said she will withdraw the controversial extradition bill, which sparked months of protest there. The plan would have allowed suspects to be tried in mainland China. If it had been scrapped a few months ago, it might have ended the unrest. But is this move too little, too late? My colleague Chloe Tilley spoke to two protesters, Priscilla and John, not his real name, to get their views.
Along with many other protesters who are very involved in this movement, also felt the concession today is much too little, much too late. We felt that this should have been conceded 3 months ago when we first staged a 1 million people protest. And yet it's only after 3 months of intense struggle and tremendous sacrifice on the Hong Kong people's part. But I do note that there are some segment of the population within the movement. Most of them are more of older age. I'm speaking, for example, my parents. They're actually happy with this concession. And we have to talk to them and tell them, hey, this is actually not okay.
I wonder what Priscilla thinks on that. Are you one of these people who's satisfied with what Carrie Lam has said?
I pretty much agree with John that I don't feel like people are satisfied, and I myself am not satisfied with this concession because apparently she has actually rejected four of our claims, four of our demands. So I don't feel like we are moving forward enough. So I feel like anger will be spurred. And also a discussion on how to continue the protest and how to continue the movement will be really brought into the surface, and people will still, you know, on debate and discuss on it.
Protesters talking to Chloe Tilley. Well, further demonstrations are planned for the 1st of October, the day that China celebrates the 70th anniversary of the founding of the Communist People's Republic. So what's behind this apparent concession from the Hong Kong authorities? Here's our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
I think it's got Beijing's fingerprints all over it, because we've heard reporting in the past few weeks done by the Reuters news agency and backed up by others to indicate that Carrie Lam wanted to formally withdraw the bill in the past, much earlier, and she was prevented from doing so by Beijing. And so I think that it's pretty clear that this is something that Beijing has agreed to. To be honest, I just don't think that Carrie Lam has enough power, enough autonomy on her own to make this kind of decision on her own. She announced a range of measures that were designed to soothe tensions. None of them, beyond the first one, really gives in to any of the protesters' demands. The protesters have been quite clear in the fact that they want Carrie Lam's resignation to begin with. They want direct elections. They want an independent inquiry into police brutality. She didn't agree to any of those. So this announcement of a formal withdrawal of the bill, yes, it is something that the protesters have been calling for, but she had already said in the past that the bill was suspended, that the bill was dead. So yes, she has used the W word, withdraw, but it only goes so far.
So what is the likely impact of this concession on the protest?
As soon as this was announced, and frankly, even when the rumours were going around that this would be announced, a lot of people were saying, this isn't enough, too little, too late. Five demands, they've said, not one less. They want all five, and then they'll stop protesting, they say. But I think there is an appetite among some in Hong Kong to just go back to normal. Some people, after 3 months of increasingly violent, increasingly aggressive protests, are ready for life to return to normal. I think this really comes at a key time. It's a key time for Beijing because they have a key date coming up, October the 1st, which will be the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. Beijing will have its largest ever military parade. They certainly don't want protests to mar that. Also, on a personal level, for many Hong Kong protesters, they're young. They're due to go back to school, and their parents are putting pressure on them to get away from the streets, to stop protesting and to hit the school books. So I think this announcement comes at a really interesting time, and I think it might have the power to sap some of the energy from those ongoing demonstrations.
Celia Hatton. Apocalyptic, one of the words being used to describe the destruction that Hurricane Dorian has brought to the Bahamas. The slow-moving storm pounded the northern part of the archipelago, the Abaco Islands and Grand Bahama, for hours. At least 20 people died. Caroline Turnquest from the Bahamas Red Cross says that flooding has left many islanders destitute.
They need every piece of help they can get. It is totally, it's devastating. It's heartbreaking when you look and see the initial videos that are coming out of there. And so we know from what we've been seeing and hearing that this one will require the help of all persons. We will need the world to help us with this one.
Our World Affairs correspondent Paul Adams assesses the damage caused by the hurricane.
Dorian has moved on, but the true extent of its ferocity is becoming clear. Mile upon mile of wrecked houses and inundated streets. Trees stripped of foliage. Whole communities reduced to piles of debris. Bahamians are used to big storms, but it's been 20 years since the government has had to deal with anything like this. The island's airport is underwater. It's the same story on Grand Bahama. It may be some time before substantial amounts of aid can reach the islands. On nearby Nassau, Red Cross volunteers are sorting donations. They know they face a mammoth task. Dorian lingered for 2 days, destroying an estimated 10,000 homes. Dorian has now reached the United States. It's been downgraded to Category 2, but it's still a huge storm, expected to cause flooding and damage as it works its way north along the coast.
Paul Adams. Residents of the southeastern United States are now bracing themselves as the hurricane moves north. As of 5 p.m. Eastern U.S. time on Wednesday, it was centered to the east of Georgia and was expected to approach South Carolina. Although it's weakened from a Category 5 storm, Dorian still has winds of 175 kilometers an hour. More than 800,000 people have received mandatory evacuation orders in the U.S. Earlier, my colleague Emilio San Pedro spoke to Gary O'Donoghue on a windy Daytona Beach in Florida.
It's also heading, we've just heard from some of the hurricane hunters, the people who fly up in those planes, up into the hurricane to measure it, that it may be edging west. Nothing is certain, but there's an increasing chance that it actually may make a landfall in South Carolina. Now, it has decreased in strength. There's still significant risk of storm surge, 3 to 5 feet in some of those areas, and there's still a lot of rain falling as well. So Florida, I think, will escape the worst of Hurricane Dorian, but South Carolina may not.
And one of the biggest concerns must be keeping people alert and wanting to be prepared for such a storm, because Dorian sat around for so long over the Bahamas. People in the east coast of the U.S. may have thought, well, it's going to go somewhere else. It won't hit us.
I think that's right. I mean, they call it fatigue, hurricane fatigue. And there is a sense, I think, across the state that perhaps people are returning to their homes sooner than they might. Certainly the authorities are worried about them doing that. So I think there is a fear that perhaps the way the hurricane, as you said, sat around, it was difficult to keep the heightened sense of awareness at top notch, if you like, for that period of time, because people were saying, well, where is it?
Gary O'Donoghue in Florida. Nigeria is boycotting the World Economic Forum on Africa in Cape Town following attacks on foreigners and foreign-owned businesses in South Africa. Stuart, a Zimbabwean businessman in Durban, says he and many others are frightened.
I feel a lot threatened because there has been circulation of WhatsApp messages on social media, which is purporting that the foreigners must leave this country and they must go back to their country of origin. So as a parent and as a business owner, I'm living in constant fear because you don't know what will happen tomorrow.
Well, attacks carried out in apparent retaliation have been continuing in Nigeria. Police there say they will increase security at embassies and foreign businesses, while the South African mobile phone company MTN is closing all its shops and service centres. Our reporter Myeni Jones is in Lagos.
Outside the shopping centre in the neighbourhood of Songotedo in eastern Lagos, the situation seems to have returned to calm. There's a heavy police presence here, and for the time being, no one is being allowed in, including workers and shop owners. The police tell us that just this morning, some protesters came trying to continue looting that had started yesterday. Although the situation is very calm today, tensions are running very high. We went to another shopping centre in Lekki, a suburb of Lagos, where one eyewitness eyewitness told us that they'd seen three Chinese nationals that were attacked by protesters yesterday. They were asked whether they were South Africans, and even though they denied, saying that they were Chinese, they were dragged out of their car. One of them was stabbed and their car was set on fire. On social media, Nigerian celebrities, including the rapper Burna Boy and the singer Tiwa Savage, have both said they will not be performing in South Africa until the violence is dealt with. The government has urged for calm on the part of Nigerians and condemned the burning of foreign businesses. And for today, South African telecoms company MTN has urged its workers to stay home today to avoid loss of life.
My Annie Jones. And still to come in the podcast.
I have a very simple definition for beauty, and that is yourself. It's just about yourself. If you be yourself, then you're beautiful.
Peter Lindbergh, the photographer credited with inventing the supermodel, has died. YouTube has been fined a record $170 million by a US regulator for violating children's privacy laws. Google, which owns the video streaming site, had been accused of collecting data on children under 13 without parental consent, as our online technology reporter Chris Baraniuk explained.
Well, YouTube has, according to the Federal Trade Commission, been targeting ads based on data gathered from videos that are clearly targeted at children. And in the US, there's a specific law that this would contravene. It's called the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA. YouTube has agreed a settlement in this case. They've been handed a big fine and agreed to make some changes to their platform. But really interestingly, one of the commissioners of the FTC, Rohit Chopra, has taken to a statement on Twitter today to complain that he doesn't think the settlement has gone far enough. And he says the fine, in his words, barely bites.
Interesting to see that Google refused to acknowledge that parts of its YouTube service were directed at children, but then in presentations to business clients, it told a different story.
Absolutely. That was one of the main lines from the FTC. They said that how can YouTube have its cake and eat it? They don't need to submit to COPPA and the rules there because their content doesn't appeal to children. And yet, at the same time, they're going to business clients, toy makers, for example, and saying, our site is really popular with children. Come and advertise with us.
So $170 million, quite a lot of money, although for Google, not that much. But will they have to change their business practices now?
There's a couple of changes. One of the most important ones is they say that they're going to stop gathering data from videos that are clearly aimed at children and using them for those advertising purposes. That's just going to be a blanket rule that they have for such videos. And the other significant change they're going to make is that those videos are going to have to be clearly labelled as intended for consumption by children.
And is this part of a wider effort by the US authorities to target these tech giants?
There is a sense that US regulators want to put a little bit of pressure on. We've seen big fines levied at some of the tech giants recently, notably Facebook. The question is how much that actually changes. As Mr. Chopra said, he wasn't sure whether this fine would really affect Google and YouTube. And of course, in YouTube's statement today, they've said they'll make some changes, but it's still unclear as to how exactly that will play out for YouTubers and indeed its reputation among parents and families.
Chris Baraniuk. A video showing how a child can surreptitiously use a hand signal to call for help has prompted a huge reaction in China. The footage appears to show a girl using the tactic while being abducted, but the film has been criticised by the authorities. I got the details from our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
One thing I should say, first of all, is this video is not real. It features actors, but some people have believed that it is. It shows a girl visibly distressed who's being ushered away by a man at an airport, and she can't cry out for help. So what she does instead is she makes a hand gesture, which is very much like the OK gesture that you can make with one hand. But if you turn it towards you so that you're facing your palm, this actually spells out the emergency service number in China, which is 110. So they're saying that this could be a subtle way that people can signal.
So it's a powerful bit of drama which shows a way that you can signal you need help if you can't talk. That sounds reasonable. Why aren't the authorities happy?
It appears to almost
have the image of a public service announcement. So people have been saying that they saw these videos on TikTok going viral, and they were under the impression that it was the police that were running them. But from the top authority, the PIAO, which is China's disinformation department, they have said that this is fake news. They've told people not to be misled by this video, that they didn't create it, and they're quite concerned that people might be teaching this to their children, because they're saying that it could actually be counterproductive. If a kid's making an OK signal, there might be people who would get involved in something where they don't need to get involved.
But part of the sensitivity of the government is that numbers have been used to signal other things in the past.
Yes, they've seen a number of cases of these. So it's very difficult for people, both online and in person, to talk about sensitive matters that the government doesn't fully back. A good example being the Tiananmen Square massacre of 1989. The number 1989 is incredibly sensitive, and the government looks at messages that feature 1989, also the day and the month, the 4th of June, 4-6, 6-4. It looks at messages like these and removes them. So people wearing T-shirts that say 4-6, the government will be very concerned. But there are circumstances in China where anybody could be in distress, and it could be something related to political sensitivities. And this is a very, very subtle way that they could convey a message and say that they need help when they can't vocalise it.
Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen. The world's first legal challenge against the use of automated facial recognition by the police has been rejected by the High Court in London. Ed Bridges had claimed that the technology used in the Welsh city of Cardiff breached privacy, data protection and equality rules. He plans to appeal against the court's decision to reject his challenge. Thomas Morgan reports.
Automated facial recognition scans a crowd comparing facial images against a watch list of crime suspects, missing people and persons of interest. While Christmas shopping in Cardiff 2 years ago, Ed Bridges was photographed by a South Wales Police AFR unit. Mr. Bridges claimed his human right to privacy, data protection and equality laws were breached. But the High Court has ruled that wasn't the case. The court said that although AFR did interfere with the privacy of those photographed, its use by South Wales Police was entirely justified and lawful, and the judicial review application was refused. The technology is being trialled in South Wales and two other areas of Britain. Concerns have been raised in the past over the technology's accuracy.
Thomas Morgan reporting. The fossilised remains of a creature resembling a millipede and the trail it left on the seafloor millions of years ago have offered scientists the earliest evidence of an animal moving and making decisions. The small prehistoric worm, which lived more than half a billion years ago, was discovered in eastern central China. Our science reporter Paul Rincon has been examining its impact.
Millions of years before the dinosaurs walked the earth, a small millipede-like creature dragged its body across the muddy ocean floor, resting along the way. Scientists now say the fossilised creature and the trail it left behind are among the oldest examples of an animal moving by itself. The marks also suggest the first sign of decision-making among animals, as it moved deliberately towards or away from something. We've seen some tracks like this before, but they've never been connected to a particular animal. The mysterious creature had a spiky body that looked like an ear of wheat, and it seems to have been related to worms. Fossils from this time period represent some of the earliest animals we know about, so studying these rare specimens can open a window into the early evolution of life on Earth.
Paul Rincon. The photographer credited with helping create the concept of the supermodel, Peter Lindbergh, has died at the age of 74. His black and white portraits changed the genre in the 1990s. More recently, he worked with Meghan, Duchess of Sussex, who married into the British royal family last year. Richard Hamilton reports.
Peter Lindbergh was born in German-occupied Poland in 1944. He studied at Berlin's Academy of Fine Arts in the 1960s and moved to Paris in 1978. He said he only took up photography after snapping pictures of his brother's children and had been trying to replicate that childlike quality in his sitters ever since. Here he is speaking to the fashion writer Lou Stoppard in 2017.
That's so amazing how they, in front of the camera, because they have no consciousness at all. And that is beautiful. And that is still, I have to say, that's like 50 years ago. That is still kind of a measurement for me.
By moving towards more simple, naturalistic portrayals of his models, without accoutrements or heavy makeup, he reinvented fashion photography. In the 1990s, he became famous for his portraits of Cindy Crawford, Linda Evangelista, Naomi Campbell and Christy Turlington, the original supermodels.
I have a very simple definition for beauty. I mean, the lowest you can get, no? You can have. And that is yourself. It's just about yourself. If you stand to yourself and you be yourself, then you're beautiful.
In July this year, he photographed, among others, the Duchess of Sussex, the climate activist Greta Thunberg, and New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern for a cover of Vogue magazine called Forces for Change. Many in the fashion industry have paid tribute to him. Linda Evangelista said she was heartbroken, and Charlize Theron recalled his kindness, warmth and sense of humour.
Richard Hamilton reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.